Hello and welcome to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM. My name is Eddie LeSure, and I'll be joined very soon by my co-host Margaret Kirshner and our special guest for this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at WPVMFM.org. This program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation, as we take an in-depth and informative look into approaches that can be integrated into daily life. All our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, our website is amindfulemergence.com. And once again, I want to welcome into the studio my co-host, Margaret Kirshner. Welcome back, Margaret.
Hi, great to be here again.
And at this point, I'd like to welcome our guest, and that's Hilary Bolter. And the topic is motivational interviewing, from ambivalence to lasting change. So welcome to the studio, Hilary. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here today.
Okay. So, that's interesting. Okay. Say hello again, Hilary.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, good. Yeah, I just had to make an adjustment on the microphone.
Okay.
And so motivational interviewing is something that Margaret and I know a little bit about, mm-hmm. but not a whole lot. And I'm just so excited about learning more about this very effective tool mm-hmm. that you use in your own practice as a therapist, but you also do trainings on this. So give us an idea what we're going to be focusing on for the next almost an hour, Hilary.
Great, thank you. I'm here to talk about motivational interviewing, about where it comes from, how it works. Maybe we'll even get to do a little demo on this hour and answer any questions that you have about the process.
Great. So exploring your background a little bit, are you from this part of the country?
You know, I grew up in Atlanta. And for those that know Atlanta, Little Five Points, Candler Park. And From there, I went out west to college in Arizona, and I did a degree in the therapeutic uses of the wilderness.
Which school out there?
Prescott College.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, I lived in Prescott for a while. That's a great school.
It is. Yes, I went out there for a degree in the therapeutic uses of the wilderness.
Cool.
Because I thought that was kind of a neat thing. I thought I had the idea. It turns out it's been around for a while.
It's kind of the Warren Wilson of the West, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so cool. Okay, so you did both your undergrad and your graduate studies there?
I did my undergraduate at Prescott, and my husband and I moved here to Asheville in 2001.
Okay.
I worked in wilderness therapy for several years, and after a while of that, my husband and I decided we'd like to see each other more and not be in and out of the field all the time. So I moved over into social work and started working with in-home family services for a number of years before I went back to school, got my master's from Chapel Hill in social work.
Excellent. Okay. And you have a practice here in the Asheville area?
I do. I have a small private practice here, so I pretty much split my time between private practice, and I work with individuals struggling with substance use, as well as other issues, including trauma and anxiety and depression. And the other half of my time, I do training and consulting in motivational interviewing.
Yeah. So you have you're a licensed clinical social worker and a licensed clinical addictions specialist.
Correct.
And you're a member of the Motivational Interviewing Network of Trainers, or MINT.
The MINT.
Since 2011.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, I joined the MINT in 2011, and that is essentially the international body of trainers. And there is no other sort of certification process for training mm-hmm. other than the MINT.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, am I correct in understanding that motivational interviewing was developed by Marshall Rosenberg?
David Rosengren is involved, but the two co-creators of motivational interviewing is Bill Miller and Stephen Rolnick.
So I was really wrong on the name. Who's Marshall Rosenberg?
Not sure. I'll have to look him up. Have a break.
Oh, well, okay.
So the co-creators, Bill Miller and Stephen Rolnick. Bill Miller wrote his first paper in MI in 1982.
Okay. And how long have you been trained in this?
I started learning motivational interviewing pretty fresh out of graduate school.
Okay.
And continued to learn from the local trainer, Annie Fahey, who's really fantastic. Mm. And eventually became so passionate about it, I applied to be in the Mint, and I went through the training for trainers and joined the Mint in 2011.
So is there anything about your upbringing in your history that prompted you to decide to become a therapist?
That's a great question. So I grew up in town Atlanta, and both of my parents worked in the helping profession. They actually met at Divinity School, and they went into different elements of the helping profession, so it really was never a question, what am I going to do? It's just a part of my job on this earth is to be of service to others in whatever ways I can. So I found wilderness therapy first, and then I moved into private practice and training. I will tell you that in 2008, when I was fresh out of my graduate program and working in this community locally to house homeless veterans, that was my first job out of graduate school, I remember feeling this tremendous sense of responsibility. Like, wow, I have people's lives in my hand. I have to know so much. And I literally felt like I had a backpack of a burden on my back as a new social worker. And coming in like fresh out of school with that excitement, wanting to help people and tell people all the resources and how I can help them and how we can help them, I started learning motivational interviewing. And I, in that process, I literally felt my shoulders drop because it wasn't my burden of responsibility of change. I should not be carrying that for my clients. It was theirs. And through motivational interviewing, I really learned how to sit with people and help hold up that mirror to the clients I work with so that they can take that backpack of burden of responsibility of change. So that's how I really felt like motivational interviewing sealed the deal for me, is I felt like I can do this work with more energy and more enthusiasm because I am not carrying the need to know everything and figure out people's paths. They know their own path.
Yeah. You're not there to fix them.
No, absolutely not.
It's kind of like you're a facilitator in some sense,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's a good word to use.
Yeah.
Facilitator.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the relationship is key, isn't it, Hillary? Talk
it
about
is.
That if you would.
Absolutely. And in the new book, the third edition of Motivational Interviewing, they recategorize the two phases of MI to the four processes. I can really geek out on you guys in MI.
We'll definitely do that in a little while.
So the first of the four processes is engagement.
Okay.
And I think that they really want to drive home that without engagement, we have nothing with the clients we work with. Without engagement, without rapport, relationship, join up on some level, the work that we're trying to do is futile. That our clients aren't going to listen to us or share with us or trust us if we don't have engagement. So really the first task in MI is to connect with people through that spirit of motivational interviewing to engage.
Mm-hmm. And of course, so many of the people you work with have had their trust violated.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So go ahead, Margaret.
I hope we'll get into how that engagement takes place.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? What does that look like? What does it sound like?
Absolutely.
So one question I want to ask you in terms of the work that you do, and I know you've done work with the VA and, mm-hmm. and you work with people in addiction recovery and a number of different issues. What are you seeing out there in the community that you run across? What kind of wounding shows up in your office?
Mm-hmm. It's intense, I will say. And I was just up in rural Kentucky training 2 weeks ago, so not exactly our community, but another community deeply affected by the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the staff that I was training there shared with me, she said, we are losing a generation of people, a whole generation of people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the time I was there, they spoke about 2/3 of the babies born in that hospital were born opioid
mm-hmm.
dependent.
Yeah. That is shocking,
right?
And sad.
It is incredibly sad. And I come back into our community. I know the epidemic is here. I see clients who struggle with this. I'm driving down the road and I saw a new sign for a Suboxone and methadone clinic today. I was like, oh, there's another new place offering those services. So I see, addiction is killing people
mm-hmm.
dramatically right now. And the other things that I run into in my practice is anxiety. There's a lot of anxiety in our culture right now, and people are struggling with how much is going on all the time and how to modulate that.
Mm-hmm. How much do you think social media contributes to that?
I personally think social media is not very helpful mm-hmm. for many people. You know, and I have clients who don't do social media on purpose because it kind of pulls them into the ups and downs of all of that. So, yeah.
Yeah. The numbers I've heard is 5 people are dying every hour in this country from opioid overdose.
Yeah.
And that's not counting other other deaths associated with substance use disorder.
Right.
You know, and car accidents.
The car accidents. And then people dying early.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing all these rock stars, you know, Tom Petty and all these people dying. And you know that the substance use in the past was a major factor. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Tom Petty was, what, 62, 63, right. something mm-hmm. like that. So those numbers don't reflect that as well.
Right. And I think, you know, tying this back into motivational interviewing, which I'll also shorten to MI, you know, we need to engage people who are substance using on any level that it takes to bring them into services. And so whatever that spectrum may look like, from replacement therapies to quitting to just cutting down or using safe needles.
Yeah.
And I know I've heard that on your show, that there's a lot of ethic around that here.
Yes, mm-hmm. there is. If you just tuned in, you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on the new WPVM LP in Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7 on your dial and streaming globally at WPVM-FM. Margaret and I are joined this week by therapist Hillary Belter, and we're talking about motivational interviewing, from ambivalence to lasting change. So let's actually define what is motivational interviewing.
Great question. So kind of the layman's answer to that is, it is a conversation about change. It is a conversation that we can have with someone who's ambivalent. And in my trainings, I first say, well, what is ambivalence? Let's define that. And when you look at the word ambivalent, ambivalence, ambi, two, valence, strength. There's strength on two sides. So when someone is ambivalent, they're in that contemplative stage of change. It really would be good for me to, but, right? And mm-hmm. we could probably say that about a dozen things in our life right now. It really would be good for me to go to bed earlier, but that's the only time I have to myself at night after mm-hmm. my kids are down. You know, I really, and in the work that I do, I really, it would be good for me to stop shooting heroin, but
yep.
I don't want to get sick. Yeah. I don't want to fill in the blank, right? So anytime that there is ambivalence about something, whether that is an external behavior, like starting something that would be healthier, quitting something, those type of things, to internal behaviors, such as maybe it would be good for me to make room for forgiveness in my heart towards so-and-so in my life. May have ambivalence about that too, but they really, you know. So motivational interviewing, whereas originally was really conceived of as something that is about a target behavior change, can also be something that is internal. And that's one of the, Bill Miller said, we are widening the tent pegs of MI. We are pulling out the stakes and capturing more within motivational interviewing.
And why is this so effective?
Right, that's a great question. MI is effective because it helps people talk about and connect more deeply to the change that they want and need to make. And so it helps to cut down on the fuzz, so to speak, of like, but I'm too tired, but I, and connect people more to the, because I want to be healthier, because I want to live, because, you know, fill in the blank, those deeper values. And this is where MI and ACT can overlap. They both really focus on internal values.
And ACT?
Acceptance and commitment therapy.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh, right.
And we've had that, we focused on that. So say just a little bit about acceptance and commitment therapy.
Oh, I'm not a great one to define
well,
that.
Give yeah. a little bit of an overview.
Right. One of the things that I understand about ACT is the big focus on values. And, you know, if you think about the theory of cognitive dissonance, that if our actions are distant from our values, then we are going to have discomfort with that when it's pointed out. And I think that is a big thing that's pulled from ACT and MI, is we are helping to create some dissonance by pointing out the discrepancy between, hey, I really want to be a good father, say, for instance, but I'm not paying child support, or I'm not doing visitation with my kids. There's a discrepancy there, and that people, when they have that pointed out in a gentle, non-confrontational way, are more likely to bring themselves back into alignment between their values and behaviors.
So, what is MI used for? I mean, you mentioned working through ambivalence, but what are the, you mentioned you work with people in addiction recovery. What else is it helpful for?
That's a great question. Motivational
interviewing. I'm going to try to keep those great questions coming. Do the best I can, Hillary.
I'll affirm you a lot during this interview.
We'll see.
Motivational interviewing was initially designed to be in the substance abuse field. Bill Miller was working in substance abuse treatment. He said, hey, this confrontational style of treatment does not seem to work for everyone. We're missing some people here. Telling people to go to 90 meetings in 90 days or else doesn't work for everyone. It may work for a few, but it doesn't work for everyone. So he developed the style of communication to reach people that were pushing back when they were pushed. So in the 80s, it was really substance abuse, and it started to spread to other health behaviors. It's my understanding at this point, Weight Watchers uses it, Aetna Health Insurance. We now have books in motivational interviewing on MI in dentistry. There's two books out on MI in schools at this point. There's books on MI with adolescents and on and on and on.
So maybe
spreading.
Teachers are learning it?
Teachers are learning it, yes.
Wow.
And it's a really fantastic tool for working with it. I mean, if you think about when the people that you work with having ambivalence, it happens frequently. You know, in my private practice, might have ambivalence about, should I start a mindfulness practice or not? Should I eat better or not? Should I get some exercise or not? And those are all things we know are good to help people's mood, right? So not even just substance abuse, but any kind of health behavior that'd be supportive. I've used it in domestic violence when I'm working with people who have some sort of violent relationship going on. Motivational interviewing is used to honor, yes, of course, you care about this person, you want to be with this person, and there's the other side to that ambivalence, which is it's not safe. Your spirit is being smothered. You know, continue on and on. So I can use motivational interviewing to help guide people towards their own resolution of that ambivalence.
Is this a good time to talk about stages of change?
Yes, sure.
Please, take us through that.
Right. So the stages of change, they kind of hit the press around the same time as MI, so they're often confused as the same thing or together. They are not the same thing, but they work together very nicely. So the stages of change, the theory is that whenever we go through a change in our life, we go through these stages to some degree or another. And the first stage of change is pre-contemplation. So pre-contemplation, before you're thinking about it. And I sort of think of that image of the proverbial ostrich with his head in the sand, as when someone is pre-contemplative, their behaviors or their words may very much look like, I don't have a problem.
Denial.
Right, it's the classic denial. And so pre-contemplative takes a little bit of that judgment out of it. I think denial is like, well, you're in denial. It's a river. That ain't no river in Egypt. Right? Whereas pre-contemplation is, oh, this person is just not thinking about this change yet. Right? And so when we see people in the court systems, we're like, well, that officer, he was this. He was, that wasn't me. You know, those.
Yeah, if he had just left me alone, we wouldn't have a problem.
It wouldn't
have,
right.
Yeah.
Smoking's no problem for me. I don't have any issues or... You know, anything, health behaviors, like I said, Weight Watchers, any kind of health behaviors increasing is good for MI. So pre-contemplative is the before we're thinking about making that change. And eventually we move into, maybe I should think about it, which is stage two, which is contemplation, thinking about that change. So maybe I was speeding that time, or maybe I did have a little too much to drink. Maybe I should do something about it. My wife is arguing with me a lot about my habits, and she doesn't like it. So that I don't really want to lose her. So maybe I better make a change in this. So thinking about making a change is that contemplation. And this is really where motivational interviewing, like, zing, like, come together.
Okay. So when they're in pre-contemplation, is there much you can do? You can't really do much? Is that
That's a hard
fair
place.
To say?
Yeah, and it's great. This is something that's been coming up in trainings a lot, because I don't want to encourage people to wash their hands of folks in pre-contemplation at all.
Mm-hmm.
When someone is pre-contemplative, they need compassion, they need open doors, they need us as providers to be willing and non-judgmental, compassionate, you know, to borrow from Carl Rogers, his unconditional positive regard, that type of spirit. It's really helpful to hold that space when people are pre-contemplative and to ask them evocative questions. about that. So tell me, I hear you say drinking isn't a problem for you, and I also hear that your wife sent you here. Tell me more about what's going on with your wife mm-hmm. being upset with you, right? Just so we're trying to kind of nudge that door open a little bit. And so with folks that are pre-contemplative, we are trying to engage. And also, we're waiting.
Right. But you're not judging.
Correct.
You're not pushing. Mm-mm. Right. So important, because then you have no chance of establishing that therapeutic relationship.
Exactly.
Right?
Right. And it's very, I think, in trainings, I will help people really feel that when we are pushed, we push back. Right? And so we practice in trainings those processes of telling each other what to do and how to do it. And you instantly feel the ante being upped in the room, where people are getting irritated and upset and pushing back. And then we say, guess what? There's this other way. Right? This comes from a good place, telling people what to do and how to do it, but it pushes people away. And for pre-contemplative, it's important to keep that engagement. So motivational interviewing really comes in at the contemplative stage of change. That's where we can really take it and run. And we continue to maintain the spirit of motivational interviewing throughout all the stages that we're walking with people through.
So there might still be some ambivalence there, but the door has been cracked open.
Yes.
All right.
And I believe ambivalence almost always exists. You know, even when someone's quit smoking, there may be some ambivalence about going back. Even when someone's quit using, there may be some ambivalence. It may have shrunk quite a lot.
Right.
So ambivalence is normal.
Yeah.
And it's there to some degree or another. We have to learn how to work with it.
I don't know if it's the same thing, but in the rooms of recovery, and I'm a person in long-term recovery, we talk about having reservations.
Yes.
So somebody could have years and years and years of recovery, but there's that little voice inside that says, well, you know, maybe when I go to the wedding, it'd be okay to have that one
glass
of champagne, because, you know, heroin was really the problem.
Right. Right. So therein creeps that ambivalence.
Right.
It creeps back in.
Right.
Right. And we have to know how to work with that. And when we push an ambivalent person, the likelihood is they will push back.
Yeah.
So we want to join with them and help them explore their own ambivalence and become more connected to the change element. And this is where motivational interviewing is a guiding style of communication. We are guiding clients in conversation with MI. It's not directive, and we're not just following, but we have our eyes on the prize, which is the change that they are wanting to make and that would be helpful for them to make.
So you have pre-contemplation, then you have contemplation, and then you have action?
Preparation.
Say more about that.
So in preparation stage, this is where you'll see behaviors where people are gathering information to make that change. They're preparing to make the change. They're finding out where the AA meetings are. They're telling their spouse that they're going to quit one day. They are buying their last pack of cigarettes. They're signing up for the treatment program, or they're, you know, even on smaller behaviors, like a preparation stage of change might be downloading the Insight Timer to start my mindfulness practice, or signing up for that Oprah's 21-day meditation experience.
Yeah.
You know, any of those.
So making that phone call.
Exactly. Preparing to make the change.
And then after
and then
that,
action.
Then action, and that's when they really start going. Really.
That's when people are in the flow of their change. And at any point, just like ambivalence can creep back in, at any point, people can move back in the stages of change. So they are linear, but also recursive. So they're making the change, and then they go, oh, never mind, this is too hard. Back to pre-contemplation. You exit the stages of change through maintenance. So that action turns into a maintenance, and then it becomes a habit.
Do you actually talk to the clients about these stages so that they can recognize where they're at?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I have a handout, and I've used it in groups before. I've passed out the stages of change and said, let's talk about these. They're big fancy words, but I bet you you'll connect to them, you know? And I'll have people stand around the room where they would put themselves around a specific target behavior and talk about, well, why are you in contemplation? Why are you in action right now? Why are you in pre-contemplation? And especially in a group, they'll start talking about it.
It must be fun to see the light go on. Yeah.
And it's really nice that you're normalizing all of these stages, that, you know, they can be, would you say, recursive?
Yes.
Meaning that, you know, you can kind of come back and forth into these stages.
It is. Change. If change were a clear, linear process for us, we wouldn't have much of the needs that we have in our healthcare industry. I can remember the moment in one of my groups at the VA where a veteran said, I wrote the word ambivalence on the board, and we started about it. He said, no one ever told me what that meant. No one ever told me that I would have ambivalence about my drinking. They all just assumed that I was going to want to quit. And I don't want to quit, right? Mm-hmm. And so we've got to normalize that first. And people stop wrestling with you because they have to stop wrestling in order to consider the change.
Yeah.
Perfect. Mm-hmm.
Talk about the writing reflex.
Oh, that's great. So this is a term coined in motivational interviewing, the writing reflex, like R-I-G-H-T, like I'm right, I'm going to fix this. And it comes from such a good place, like bless us, all helping professionals. We're in this to change lives and to help people. And writing reflex behaviors really can look like telling people what to do or how to do it. I mean, don't you just think that, right? You know, and this writing reflex will creep into me when I'm really tired in my private practice. And it's towards the end of the day and I want to say, well, just if you would just wake up earlier, then you could exercise before you went to work.
I know. Isn't it obvious?
Isn't it obvious? Right? But I teach this in trainings. I say, anytime you want to say something to a client to tell them to do something, see if you can get them to say it. Try to craft the conversation to say, when might be a good time for you to exercise? What would that look like for you to take a step in the direction of? What time of day would it be? You know, so that you're getting the client to come up with the answers instead of us imparting that.
So one of the principles of MI is understanding and exploring the person's own motivations.
Yes.
How do you find that out?
Right, we have to get to know our clients,
don't
we?
Ask the right questions.
We do, and open-ended questions, asking evocative questions is one of the elements of motivational interviewing. And so we learn, I mean, we must be curious. We must sit with our clients, not assuming that we know them or that we know the way out of the woods, so to speak, but to ask them, tell me about your life. What's going on? How do you see the world? How do you see this problem that you're here to talk about?
Mm-hmm. You know, we were having a conversation, Margaret and I, recently, and she was talking about the question, what happened to you? Do you want to say more about that, Margaret?
Oh, this is regarding trauma. Instead of asking the person, you know, why, or, you know, what is your current symptom? Instead, you just kind of, you know, go back in time. What happened to you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you think that is influencing your current behavior?
Right. Beautiful. And one of the tools in MI is asking about a typical day. And so just asking, like, tell me about a typical day. Tell me about a typical drinking day. What time do you wake up? What's the next thing you do? And really get all those details of, like, what's going on in someone's life. I really feel like a part of the spirit of motivational interviewing is to maintain curiosity and to demonstrate empathy through reflective listening, so that our clients really get that we are making that effort to see the world through their lens.
So give us an example of reflective listening.
Great. So in motivational interviewing, we talk about simple reflections and complex reflections. And simple reflections are a restatement of what someone said. And complex reflections are when we take that to another level. So for instance, I was training with some Child Protective Services staff, and they made a statement like, here's a typical client statement. What's the point of filing this case plan? You're going to take my kids anyways. So a simple reflection might just be to restate that. You think we're going to take your kids anyways. A complex reflection would be taking that to a deeper level. It's when we add meaning or emphasis to what the client has said. We're stating what they have not yet said. And so if a client says, what's the point of doing this case plan anyways? You're going to just take our kids. A more complex reflection might be, this feels hopeless. You're scared about what could happen here. You don't trust me. So we're making a reflective statement that gets at what is beneath.
Yeah. What's really the fear?
Right.
What's really the concern?
Yeah, let's go deeper. Because when we go deeper, we can access change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to pause for just a few minutes, and I always take a musical break. You're listening to A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And Margaret and I are going to return with our guest, Hillary Bolter, in just 3 minutes. I've got a brief musical pause. I picked out a song composed and performed by Thelonious Monk. Thelonious Monk and his composition Round Midnight. This is Eddie LeSure, and from 7 to 8 p.m. every Monday on WPVM, Margaret Kirshner and I are joined by guests who share their unique experience and expertise in their effort to support personal and planetary healing and wholeness. In addition to tuning in at 103.7 FM or WPVMFM.org Mondays from 7 to 8 p.m. when we're live, or Thursdays from 9 to 10 a.m. when we have the rebroadcast, past programs are archived on our show host page for your convenience. It's easy to locate them. Just select the schedule at WPVMFM.org and click on this program. It's listed Mondays at 7 p.m. We are broadcasting live March 12, 2018. This is program 113. All our shows are made possible by A Mindful Emergence, LLC, our Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. You can access more information online at amindfulemergence.com. You can also find us on Facebook and LinkedIn. And I want to mention another program that's on WPVM in particular that I suggest you check out if you enjoy this show. And that's called A Better World. And I invite you to join McNair Ezard Thursdays at 5 p.m. He brings in people and organizations that are working in areas such as hunger and poverty, economic and social justice, and the environment and spirituality. And I've asked Margaret if she would share. There's an upcoming event later this month on March 29th that I think it would be good for our listeners to know about. Go ahead, Margaret.
Everyone is invited to a community screening of a documentary, and it's called Crazy Wise. And a human rights photographer named Phil Borges witnessed how indigenous cultures often identify psychotic symptoms as an indicator, actually, of potential, growth potential. And so the way that we view mental illness in our culture is very different from what some other cultures do with mental illness. So this film is going to be shown on Thursday, March 29th at the Grill Movie House, 6:30 p.m. The movie ends about 8 p.m., but afterward there will be a panel discussion by experts who will answer questions. The cost is $12 per person. Grill Movie House is located on 45 South French Broad Ave in Asheville. And parking is free, and it's across the street from the theater.
All right. Well, thanks for letting us know. Really looking forward to that. And we did have Phil Borges as a guest. Gosh, I know it was about 3 or 4 months ago to talk about this, and it's an amazing movie. So we're going to return back now to our guest, therapist Hillary Bolter, and talking about motivational interviewing, from ambivalence to lasting change is our theme. And one thing that you mentioned when we were off air, Hillary, was that you also work with people who are at risk for suicide.
Sure.
Maybe you could say more about that on air.
Absolutely. So when we talked earlier in the show about all of the different areas that motivational interviewing is used in, from substance abuse to health behaviors and so on, suicide prevention is another one of those. Essentially, again, anywhere that a client has ambivalence, we can use motivational interviewing to help guide them towards that change that they need to make. And so when someone is sitting in my office and is feeling suicidal, that is ambivalence. To live or to die. That person is on the fence about that. And so exploring with them, well, tell me what it is, why you want to die. What would be helpful about that? First, because we need to recognize and listen to the stuck parts, to the sustained parts that people are experiencing. So when someone's talking with me about their alcohol use problem, tell me why you love about alcohol. Why are you drinking? How is it helping you? We want to explore that side with people. But we don't want to stay there. So then we guide the conversation towards the other side, towards the change side. So if someone's saying, I'm feeling like I'm not sure if I'm safe to go home today, right? So exploring, tell me some of the reasons that you might want to end your life right now. And then tell me some of the reasons why ending your life right now may not be the best choice. Tell me more about who is important to you. What would you be missing? And guide that conversation more deeply to their loved ones, on, and continue to use that reflective listening that I gave you a short demo earlier. Oh, so your kids would be without a father. What would that be like for you to leave your kids right now? And just really help people feel the gravity of that so that they are less likely to make that decision. Now, we still have to do all the clinical things we do to assess safety and do committals if we have to, but to have those conversations and motivational interviewing is an evidence-based practice, and this is one of the areas that there has been evidence that supports MI as an EBP in the suicide prevention area.
Yeah, I saw something like over 300. Did I understand
over 200 clinical studies have demonstrated and found MI to be beneficial.
Yeah. And in terms of what you were just talking about, we're kind of circling back to a point you made early on in the program. You're really holding the mirror up. I love that.
Yes.
It's like, so reflecting back to them the picture so that they can see it for themselves.
Right. And when people are in crisis, they don't have the whole big picture.
Right, right.
They're honed in. And so holding up that mirror to help people really see themselves and to see the choices that they're making and to develop some discrepancy where they say, well, health is really important to me, but I'm eating it at fill in the blank every day on my way home from work. So that we're developing that discrepancy and helping through that process, helping people realize that they do want to make a change in that area. And motivational interviewing is not confrontational. It's the opposite of confrontational. We're not trying to be confrontational or combative with our clients. But it is to confront, is to confront face to face, to bring face to face. So we are helping people confront to bring face to face with their own realities and their own lives and their own decisions, because every decision that someone's going to make about change is up to them.
Do you get into talking about the consequences of their decisions, or
absolutely. You know, one of the tools, the fork in the road, where I'll say, okay, you're standing at a fork in the road right now, and down you go down the left fork and things stay the same. Let's play that out. And tomorrow you wake up and you're still using. What's that going to be like? Okay, so you probably sleep late because you're going to have a bit of a headache. And then what happens? And you get up and do what? And who are you seeing? And what does your life look and feel like? And then the next day, and in 5 weeks, and in 1 year, what is that? Oh, I might be dead. You know, at some point, that person knows. People know what their life is going to look like if you ask the right questions. Mm-hmm. And then we say, okay, so you got a real picture for what your life is going to look like if you don't make a change in this area. So do you mind if we go back and revisit this other road? So tell me what would happen if you did make a change. How are you going to wake up tomorrow? And this is where there's a little overlap with solution focused therapy. The miracle question, you wake up tomorrow morning, what's going to happen? You know, I had someone tell me, he said, well, I would wake up to an alarm and there'd be sun coming through the window. And I said, and then what would happen next? He said, my feet would hit the floor and I'd be looking across the room and I'd have a closet full of clothes. Because this is someone who was using crack cocaine and living on the streets. And I said, oh, you'd have a closet full of clothes. What kind of clothes? I'd have work clothes. And then he told me he would go and make breakfast, right? And he'd have food. And he walked through that day, right, of change. And then 5 weeks from there and a year from now and 5 years, my daughter would be back in my life and my grandkids. And, you know, getting people to really connect to that vision and taste it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Engaging the senses, you know, like what would that feel like, smell like, taste like? Do you do that? Does that help too?
Absolutely, right? Yeah. I think those of us that are trauma-informed people really know that the body and the nervous system need to connect to that as well.
Absolutely. So one of the things that you mentioned earlier when we were preparing to do the show is it would be fun to do a role play. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be really useful for our listeners to see how you go through it. And Margaret, being the spiritual warrior that she is, is willing to jump in and engage in that. So I'm going to turn this over to the two of you.
Wonderful. Thank
you. Sit back.
Right. And so one of the things when I am using motivational interviewing with a client or a colleague, I am considering where I am rowing towards, where we're going towards. What is that target change? And so what is that the person is feeling ambivalent about, and how to guide that person towards change? And so I thought I would read the technical definition of MI, and then you all can tell me afterwards if you feel like we were using MI in this conversation. So MI is a collaborative, goal-oriented style of communication with particular attention to the language of change. It is designed to strengthen personal motivation for and commitment to a specific goal by eliciting and exploring the person's own reasons for change within an atmosphere of acceptance and compassion. It's a big, fancy, long definition. So acceptance and compassion, when I work with people, we're holding the MI spirit, empathy, partnership, collaboration, curiosity. I'm using my OR skills, which those of you that learned MI, open-ended questions, affirmations, reflections, and summaries. And I'm rowing the conversation, guiding the conversation towards change, towards resolution of the ambivalence in the direction of change. It's a lot at once. Okay, so would you share with us that thing that you're feeling ambivalent about? So I asked her to pick something that she was in the contemplative stage of change about.
Okay, so a little background. I have just recently started a new job as a substance abuse counselor, where patients come in and they see me for short chunks of time. And, you know, I'm very interested in hearing and learning about them and their experience, and very eager to offer help. Mm-hmm. And yet I know that I have a limited amount of time and a lot of work to get done in that chunk of time. So I guess my ambivalence is about wanting to dive deep, but knowing I only have a short amount of time to do that.
Right. So you want to do the quality, heartfelt work.
Correct.
And keep the boundaries.
Yes.
To your therapeutic hour.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And what are some of the benefits of making a change in that for you, to keep that boundary to the hour?
I will be more efficient with my time management, because that is a part where I am struggling. I am not so efficient with my time, and I'm feeling like I can't get all my work done in the hours of the day.
You really want to be more efficient with your time.
I do.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the ideas, if you were to take a little baby step in that direction, what are some of the ideas you have?
Let's see. Letting them know at the beginning of the conversation that we have a short amount of time, and I'm very interested in hearing their most important concern.
Right. So you could sort of frame the conversation at the beginning, letting them know how much time you have,
mm-hmm.
and saying it's still important for me to hear what's most important to you.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So that's what one of the solutions that you have for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so you said that it was important to make this change because you want to be both heartfelt and timely.
Correct.
With your clients.
Yeah, I do.
What else sort of supports the reasons behind keeping that boundary in place?
Because I realize that there are so many needs, and they can rely on me exclusively to solve their problems, and I know I can't solve everything that's going on with them.
Ah, so if you give clients even more time, they may become more reliant on you.
Yes.
To solve their problems.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So that's kind of another supporting reason why having some boundaries would be helpful.
Yes.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I get that. It's important mm-hmm. to you to have your clients really own their own struggles that
right,
they're working with.
Right, and I feel like sometimes they can go round and round and ruminate, and I can kind of go round and round with them there, and I don't feel after a while that I'm helpful.
Right. Yeah, you even kind of, your eyes got wide there. You're like, round and round. It kind of feels like, whoa. Right. And so there's a part of you that really wants to get that conversation more concise.
Correct.
Yeah absolutely.
I do.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things you're saying would be helpful would be to state to the clients, we've got a boundary here in terms of how much time we've got. I wonder what other ideas you might think of that could help you pull that in.
I like hearing what other counselors are doing. I like getting feedback from colleagues and coworkers and hearing you and having these kinds of open-ended questions.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. So if you wanted some more tips, then you might approach some of your colleagues mm-hmm. to say, like, how do you do it? How do you keep it within, you
exactly.
know? Because our clients come and they're like, blah,
yes.
lots of stuff
yes.
going on.
Yeah.
So we want to take charge of pulling that conversation and focusing it without stepping on their feet
right.
and not meeting their needs. So you've got a nice idea there of how to balance that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you need more tips, you'd go to some colleagues.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I hear you. Yeah. And I wonder how you would know that you were being successful at that.
I would feel that our time was well spent. I would stick to the time. I would feel as though I were touching on maybe one or two points rather than 16.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it would feel less chaotic to you.
Feel less chaotic,
uh-huh.
less, yeah. Yeah, less scattered,
mm-hmm.
more cohesive at the end. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I would feel like I've made a connection with the person, or I understood the situation, and that I could summarize it afterward.
Nice. Right. So you'd be both caring and concise.
Right.
Mm-hmm. To have that balance
mm-hmm.
where you're connecting to the clients, their needs are being met within the frame.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds like you even would give a sigh if that was happening.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So you've got an idea, a couple ideas on how you might start doing that, and
mm-hmm.
sounds like it's a direction that you may decide to go.
Yeah, certainly.
In your work. Okay.
Yeah, I can do that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
There's a little demo.
There we go. How did that feel, Margaret?
That feels supportive and compassionate, and it did feel like I was given the room to kind of come up with my own solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I would like. Usually clients have better solutions than we have for them, right? Clients learn what the Blaise Pascal quote is, we learn what we believe by hearing ourselves speak.
Mm.
And so I'm wanting to pull that out of you. I will tell you that the moment you started talking, my writing reflex kicked in, and I wanted to tell you about how I handled my time and how I've managed that learning curve at jobs.
And I would love to hear that.
Right? But that doesn't make the conversation about you.
Okay.
It makes it about me.
Okay.
And my ideas or suggestions may not work for you. So first, I want to pull out, how would you do it? Why is this important to you? How might you go about doing this before I may offer some tips or ideas, right? So the acronym we use in MI, ask, offer, ask, AOA, ask, offer, ask. So I'm going to ask you first, and then maybe I might offer an idea, and then I might see how that would fit for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I might say, well, in my sessions, I use a chimer bell, and I tell my clients, I say at 45 minutes, the timer chimes, and that knows we have about 5 minutes to wrap up.
I see.
Right? So that works for me.
I could do
how
that.
How might that work for you? Right.
So I like that.
Then I want to check back in with the client about how that might fit for them. So it may not fit. Oh my gosh, that sounds rude, right? Somebody might say that. I say, okay, well, what might be another idea for you? My method is not the right one. I heard a great story in NPR years ago. I was driving to the VA, and it was the Hidden Brain podcast. And there was a study on empathy. And the question posed in the study was, are we more empathetic when we have been through the issue or not? And I struggled with my empathy because I have been through that issue with you.
Yeah.
So I had to work harder to quiet my writing reflex and truly listen.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes having been through something is not that helpful?
It can make it harder to truly listen.
Oh.
Because we have our own story going. We are along the stages of change in a different place than that person is. So we can actually lose empathy if we're not careful. So I feel like as a practitioner, when I have had a similar experience to my clients, I have to work harder not to identify.
That's interesting.
And keep the story about them.
Mm-hmm. I can see how that could happen.
And the temptation is to say, you know, I can really understand what you're dealing with. Yeah, when that happened to me, this is what I did. So, you know,
exactly.
You wouldn't say it like that.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, it doesn't sound so much like we're giving advice, but we really are, aren't we?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Right, and sometimes advice is wanted.
Sure.
And oftentimes, people really just need to talk and get more clear about their own process to come to their own conclusions. And that advice or giving information just muddies the waters.
Okay. Well, I have a question for you. Sometimes we have patients who, the way I put it is, they get lost in their story.
Mm.
And they get lost in their story and an investment in this story so much that they really struggle to be solution-oriented.
Right.
I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
That's a good question. When folks are very identified and stuck in their stories, I would certainly want to let them tell their story first. And one of the types of complex reflections that we use is a double-sided reflection where we are naming both sides of the ambivalence. So on one hand, I hear that you have really been a victim of X, Y, and Z. And on the other hand, you've come here to counseling, I'm guessing, because you're ready for some change. Tell me more about what change might look or feel like. Because when people are ambivalent, they want their ambivalence recognized and that stuckness recognized. I hear that you're stuck and it's really hard and depression is overwhelming and you don't feel like getting up and getting out. And there's this other part of you that has some ideas about how you might do that if you were going to. Even when I don't hear ambivalence, in motivational, we assume there is, and we want to uncover it.
Hmm.
So it's really, I feel like we're hope holders in this field. We hold the hope, even when our clients can't see it, and we're still saying, yeah, it's there. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Do you struggle to not be a cheerleader for change?
Mm-hmm. That's a great...
I find myself starting to be a cheerleader for recovery.
Right.
You can do it. Every day somebody decides to get clean and stop, you know, and I go, oh, man, I think I'm really starting to sound obnoxious.
I believe there is a place for cheering, right, and support in that way. In motivational interviewing, we use affirmations instead of cheering, and there is a difference. And I, you know, I remember one person I worked with struggling with crack cocaine use who said to me, you know, he used for decades and decades. And when he would come and see me, when he made a change and he was like, I've been clean for like 2 weeks, the cheerleader in me, and I have a strong one, so I got to keep her quiet, says, like, you go. I'm so proud of you. That's awesome. You got this.
You want to high five him.
High five, right? But what happens when he's relapsed and comes back?
Shame.
Shame. He's not going to even come back because he knows that I praised him for one set of behaviors.
Right.
Then he's going to assume shame for the others. So an affirmation is a specific statement of a strength or effort. And so I would say to him, you look really bright-eyed. You've been doing something that's making you feel better. Tell me about that, right? So I'm honing in on the strength that he has, that underlying strength, or the effort that he's taking to make this change, so that he's connecting more deeply to that part of him. Because we don't want to train people to keep coming back for our cheers.
Yeah.
We want them to see the strengths inside of them and take that out with them.
And we don't want to
brilliant.
We don't want to suggest that there's this expectation that we're placing on them.
Right.
And if they don't measure up, they're not okay.
Right. Then you failed. And then we've got a whole other layer that's working against us.
So we're starting to, this hour has just flown by. I know one thing I want to point out is that there are a lot of people who say they're practicing motivational interviewing. If somebody out there wants to work with a therapist who has really authentically been professionally trained, what kind of questions should they ask, Hillary?
That's a great question, and I can get my bee in my bonnet about this a little bit, because I think it's been many decades now since MI has been around, and a lot of people have taken a training on some degree or another. We know that the research shows that when someone sits through a training of 12 hours or more, that following a training, there's no decrease in MI inconsistent behavior, like directing or confronting. There is a spike in reflective listening, but at 90 days, there's no change in behavior without follow-up. So that if someone is truly going to learn motivational interviewing, it takes follow-up. It takes a training of 2 or 3 days followed with ongoing training and consultation. So I would ask your provider, tell me what your exposure to MI has been. There is currently no certification process for becoming MI certified, but if someone has been through multi-month consultation period, they are more likely to have MI.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So a weekend training probably isn't going to get it done. It might open the door.
Open the door.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a zillion learning resources out there. The motivationalinterviewing.org website is the Mint website. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of training resources. That's where you can find Mint trainers and trainings offered by Mint members.
So if someone wants to take one of your trainings, how can they get information?
Certainly. You're welcome to come to my website for more information. That's bolterconsulting.com. And I have an upcoming training for dietitians in May, and I'll be offering one for general public in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you also have a private practice. If someone wants to work with you one-on-one, how can they get information?
Same through that website or my name, hillarybolter.com. Two routes to contact me. Most of the work I do is working with agencies to train directly for them. So about once a year, I open one to the public. I'll do that in the fall.
And in the minute we have left, is there anything else about motivational interviewing that you really want to point out that maybe we haven't covered?
I appreciate the questions and the conversation. It really does feel like I'm sitting around a coffee table talking to you two today. I encourage people, I say that the process of learning MI is simple but not easy.
Mm-hmm.
There are very simple concepts that people really identify with and take to. And it takes practice and repetition to keep us from our writing reflex and confronting and telling people what to do and falling back to some of those really well-intentioned habits that we have to help people change.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Hillary Bolter, appreciate so much you coming on and sharing your experience and insights into motivational interviewing. Appreciate
it. I'm so grateful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, both of you.
You bet.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you to our listeners once again for joining me. And I invite you to check with us next week when I'm going to be joined by Kevin Mahoney and Sue Polston from Sunrise Community talking about the growing edge of North Carolina's certified peer support. So please join us again.